wanted to thank everyone again for joining the call and for listening in. I wanted to introduce everyone to our moderator for today. Her name is Nosheen Omar, and she shared briefly during the Circle of Sharing. Nosheen is actually an inspiration in herself. Maybe you got a glimpse of that from her share, and hopefully one day she'll be a featured guest on the call. But just some background on Nosheen. She actually, one story about hers, she actually used to work in the financial world in New York City and worked for a large bank. And, when she was really looking at the work that she was doing and she was starting to see some of the negative impact on the policies and the impact it would have on consumers like you and me, it just overwhelmed her conscience, it overwhelmed her heart. And she just decided that, it just did not align with her values, and she up and quit. And she didn't have another job in hand. She didn't have a plan B or anything like that. It just did not fit with her values, and so she left. And, just maybe it'll give you a glimpse of a little bit about who Nosheen is and what makes her as the moderator today. She's actually a student of Ilias's, and she's been inspired in many ways by Ilias's teachings and whatnot. So, Nosheen, if you could, if I can hand things over to you, and maybe you can introduce Ilias and take us through. Again, Ilias, thank you very much for taking time this Saturday, this morning, to grace us all with your presence.
Wonderful. Thank you, Amit. And thank you, everyone. I'm really delighted to be here. For the record, I've never been given such a gracious introduction for walking out of Citigroup, so thanks. I appreciate that. hello, everyone. I've had the opportunity to attend these forest calls as a guest in the recent past, but today I feel particularly grateful to have the opportunity to host the call for Ilias. Ilias, welcome. I'm so honored to be here with you. Before I begin, I know the folks on the call got to read a little bit about your work, but I'd like to provide an introduction for those joining us here, and also would like to share my own story of how I first got to know about your work and what inspired me about it. So for the callers today, the word Hakim that you've seen in the introduction email is the professional title for someone who is a practitioner of traditional Islamic healing and medicine. Hakim Ilias's traditional Islamic healing and medicine training began at 6 years of age through his father, who raised him with a deep sense of reverence for all races, cultures, and religions of the world. Ilias received his undergrad degree in mining engineering from Virginia Tech and also completed a pre-med curriculum. Now, I know you're wondering, how does someone do mining engineering and pre-med and then find themselves as a practitioner of traditional medicine? And so we would be exploring that more today. Since 1990, Ilias has studied meditation, yoga, qigong, acupuncture, Chinese herbal medicine, homeopathy, Japanese and Tibetan Reiki, and osteopathic manipulation. He studied Chinese medicine at the Traditional Acupuncture Institute in Columbia, Maryland, where he was awarded the Master of Acupuncture degree and is National Board Certified. Ilias studied Chinese herbology at the Academy for Five Element Acupuncture in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. What's interesting is in 2000, Ilias started a nonprofit center of traditional medicine called the Circle of One, with the intention of helping people in need, regardless of their ability to pay, especially children with developmental issues. And staying true to the principle of actually never turning anyone away who asks for help, regardless of their circumstances. Since opening and founding Circle of One, Ilias has never taken a salary. His current project, Hakim Wellness, aims to revive the study and practice of traditional Islamic healing and medicine. And as part of this, the initiative includes building a health education retreat center in the Bay Area. This one I'm particularly excited about is filming a documentary on traditional Islamic healing and medicine from Morocco to China. And the last one being forming a global network of traditional medicine for mutual support in preserving, developing, and sharing of this ancient medical knowledge. Hakim Ilias was appointed as the Associate Executive Director of the Park 51 Wellness Center in New York in January last year. He also frequently lectures on various subjects relating to religion, spirituality, Eastern philosophy, traditional healing and medicine, and personal development. So it was one of these lectures that Elias was giving that I first had the chance to hear him speak. That was at Zetuna College in Berkeley, California. And I have to be honest, that was the first time I was hearing of traditional medicine, and even then learning about something called traditional Islamic healing and medicine. So I wasn't someone who was aware of this field, didn't have any insight into these healing techniques, and quite frankly wasn't even looking for help or healing in this regard. I was just there, I happened to be on campus, and as someone who's had an interest in health and wellness, attended the lecture. However, what I didn't know, and this is something I think all of us can relate to, was that, you know, I was having one of those nagging symptoms as a result of daily lives, busy lives in the daily grind. And I was just looking for like a quick fix way to alleviate my symptoms. So having just recently heard Elias's lecture and being close to campus, I went to Elias looking for help with the problem. You know, like a solution, a quick fix. And surprisingly, I learned that the unsuspecting benefits from actually addressing the underlying cause of the problem. And so with the help of techniques, such as guided meditation and changes to lifestyle that Elias helped me identify, I was able to see the cause of the problem instead of just masking the symptoms. I thought I would share that perspective in the introduction as, you know, someone who wasn't aware, not interested, and even somewhat skeptical of traditional medicine, to being pleasantly surprised in terms of finding the benefit, not just addressing the problem, but also as a result, improving health and overall wellness. And that is also the reason why today I'm now embarking on this journey of studying this for myself, with a goal to ultimately extend this to others in the same spirit of service that Elias has. So Elias, welcome. I'm delighted to have you with us today. I'd like to start by asking, what is traditional Islamic medicine and how is it different from regular medicine?
Thank you, Nasheen. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining the Forest Call. It's really a great honor to be here in this time to present this subject. So I want to thank all of the helpers, and especially Nipun for the invitation, and Nosheen for hosting, and Amit and the crew for all the background support. So to respond to the first question, traditional Islamic medicine, first I'll start by saying that the terminology I use to describe systems like Islamic medicine or Ayurveda or Chinese medicine or Tibetan medicine is traditional medicine. Usually when people hear that term, the first thing they think of is modern medicine, but it's actually a misnomer. That real traditional medicine is really based in a tradition of spirituality, because the role of healer, the role of physician, was synonymous with the spiritual figures of the community, whether it was a shaman or a priest or some kind of cleric, that the religious person was also not merely religious outwardly, but was the sort of spiritual pole of the community. And also that really came with the function of healing and medicine, because it has everything to do with the soul. Whereas today, the practice of medicine has so very little to do with the soul in the modern context. So when I say traditional medicine, that's what I'm referring to. And it's also the definition that the World Health Organization uses, as opposed to modern medicine, which you can alternatively call conventional medicine, since it's just the convention that we know in the West. Now, in the West, traditional medicine is instead called complementary or alternative medicine. And those terms are all right, but really they don't get to the heart of it. So just that's a little point of clarification. So traditional Islamic medicine is basically a science that is based in the scripture of Islam and the prophetic sayings of the Prophet of Islam, may the peace and blessings of God be upon him, that basically delineates the relationship of the soul to the body. And so in traditional medicine, it is believed that human beings have a subtle body. And the term that I use for that is the soul. And it's the vehicle of life experience. And it goes through transformation and it learns.
as opposed to spirit, which is not an individual, not a purely individual thing, that spirit is, that there's one spirit that illuminates every soul. And through spiritual practice, one essentially is aligning the individual soul with this one spirit. So then your spirit with the small s is your experience of the one spirit with the capital S. So these are the terms that I use that will be relevant to this discussion. So traditional Islamic healing and medicine is the science as well as art. And the science of it comes out of the scripture and the prophetic sayings and practices. And it basically describes the relationship of the soul to the body. And so the body being this incredible gift given to us that reflects to us directly everything that is going on in the soul. So it is an incredible feedback mechanism by which we're kept honest with ourselves, that whatever is going on in your soul, your body is going to talk to you about it. It's going to communicate with you. And if you take the time to pay attention, to pause and to listen, it has a lot to say about the quality of your interior experience, the extent to which you're being true and honest to with yourself, and also how you're interfacing with the world, with people, with nature. And so one of the principles in traditional medicine in general, and especially in Islamic medicine, is this idea of the unity of existence, that we are not merely connected in a kind of linear Newtonian way, but everything in a much deeper way, in a quantum way, if you will, is really one. That what is happening inside of your brother or your sister across the planet is simultaneously on some level happening inside of you. That we are not at all separate. We're actually connected in obvious ways and deeply connected in less obvious ways. So a human being can never be fully at peace if there is a single human being on the planet who is not fully at peace. And so this is quite profound, and its implications in terms of healing and medicine are extraordinary. So for example, if you have some kind of difficulty in any relationship you have in life with anyone, no matter how far away they might be, if they are upset with you, you will feel it in your soul. If you are on good terms with them and there's really love flowing between your hearts, you will also feel that in your soul. And in this way, we are really held quite accountable by the fruits of all of our words and our deeds. And this manifests in subtle ways and also in very obvious ways. So I'll stop there. I mean, there's a lot more I could say about that, but I don't want to.
No, that's thank you, Ilyas, that for that clarification on traditional medicine and tying it into the unity of existence. You talked about body and soul, and so what I'd like to, so today that there's that buzzword, mind body soul connection, and sort of fashionable to speak about it, but talk to us about that connection where how mind body and soul are connected, and in the context of not internally just amongst ourselves, but also with the universe, which was sort of what you were just segueing into.
So we actually had, going back to one of the friends that shared earlier, the experience of, I think it was Prakash or Rajesh sharing our recent visit to the Wilderness Sanctuary last weekend with Steve, which was quite extraordinary, where you really get to see how your thoughts and emotions and your energy is constantly affecting everything around you. and the animals respond to, they're very sensitive to that. They respond to it immediately. So this is, so yes, today, you know, you hear the word mind-body connection, and it's basically a safe way to talk about the subtleties of the human reality. And the word soul is avoided because modern science doesn't like that word, really. And the word mind in itself is also kind of a confusing term because it means something completely different in a Buddhist context versus a secular context. But at least mind-body connection is a decent start in a conversation, and science has to kind of tread carefully in what it talks about because it stands in its own construct, which requires, you know, evidence. And so, but the reality is it's really mind, body, soul, or body, mind, soul, if you want to follow the order of, let's say, the gross, the dense, to the more subtle. And so the mind is really an aspect of soul, but it's a particular aspect that is worth mentioning. So I like the term body, mind, soul myself. But the soul speaks of this higher reality that is right here. And many people throughout the ages have described experiences of the soul beyond the body, such as out-of-body experiences. And, you know, people who have died, who have had, you know, they've flatlined and they've been brought back or somehow came back and described the experience of leaving the body. And consciousness was still very active and all the senses were present. And they were able to see and notice things while also knowing that they had left their bodies. So this is a central consideration really in medicine. And this has everything to do with why most of my patients were people who were in a sense beyond modern medicine, that the doctors didn't know what else to do for them. They couldn't quite figure out what was going on with them. So I'll give you some very simple examples that we're all very familiar with. So you feel sadness or grief, and suddenly there's a welling up of fluid that comes up into the face, to the eyes, and then one starts crying. Or you step out, you know, you're frightened, and suddenly you have a need to evacuate your bladder immediately. Or a person is deeply frightened, you know, startled, panicked, and there's an urge to evacuate their bladder, but they can't hold it, and so they, you know, they wet themselves. A person gets angry and they tighten up, the blood pressure goes up, heart rate goes up, and they heat up. And in an extreme case, one will even burst the blood vessels in the eyes so that the whites go bright red and they can be sort of, and their vision can be distorted for some weeks after that. So these are all examples of psycho-emotional experiences that have an immediate physical manifestation. Now, consider this. Those are very obvious experiences that we have really on a daily basis. But the ones that tend to get overlooked are things like the chronic insecurity or the chronic negativity, all the sort of subtle psycho-emotional experiences that gnaw away at us, that aren't so loud that we have an immediate physical event in the present moment about which we have to take action, but rather the subtle things that aren't so loud but are ever present and endure for a decade or more. And so often when people are diagnosed with a chronic illness, they will feel surprised, like it really came out of the blue, such as cancer, for example. But in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, these are things that developed gradually over a long period of time from the subtle stuff of the soul, that if they had taken the time to listen to it, to allow themselves to experience it and to face it and understand it and ultimately liberate themselves from it through a healthy interior healing process, then their bodies would have been freed from that negative energy, and it would not have turned into this chronic illness.
No, that's I appreciate the reshifting to say body, mind, and soul, and you're giving us a sense of the subtle things that all of us at some level have to have faced in terms of psycho-emotional experiences, Ilyas. I'm curious, Ilyas, in terms of some of the stories of individuals you've treated in terms of healing in this regard, because prior to the call when we talked about healing, some of the things that I assist with healing is when we scratch ourselves, we eventually the eventually heals, or emotional hurt, and that we heal through that hurt. But you've talked about the kinds of healing that that are even more subtle than that. So what are some of the stories of patients you've healed or seen heal in terms of working through some of these subtle experiences?
So back in the year 2000, I believe, I had someone that I'd met. My mother had, she had a little coffee shop in just outside of Washington, D.C. So I would meet a lot of people there, and we would chat on the couch in her coffee shop. And so I met this lady, and she had expressed an interest in coming in for treatment, and she never did, but she found my phone number maybe a year later, and she called me up, but she was unable to come in and see me because she was essentially bedridden. Her right lung had collapsed, and her left lung was still functioning, but she was almost non-functional. She was exhausted all the time, and she saw a surgeon who basically said, you need to take care of this, and you need to make a decision soon, and at most you have 6 months before this could become, dangerous. And so she called me up, and we were having this conversation on the telephone. And so I never actually treated her in person. I essentially treated her on the telephone. But of course, she didn't know it at the time because we were basically just having a conversation. And so I was trying to get to the bottom of what was going on, because there was no physical trigger for this medical event that modern medicine could explain. So I was asking questions and trying to get a sense of what is it that happened in her life just before this lung collapsed. And she was a filmmaker, and I discovered that she basically lost a sense of who she is and what really matters to her. And so she was creatively at a loss, and was at this stage in her life where she had lost her sense of meaning. And so I spent an hour and a half practically on the phone with her, asking questions to help her find herself again. And in the moment when she was able to finally articulate who she really is, like her deepest values and what really matters to her, which is ultimately what got her into making films in the first place. So she realized that, she remembered, and the next step was to get her to articulate how her work was really an expression of who she really is, and how that really matters, and that she has a contribution to make in the world, and the voice of who she really is comes out through her films, and that matters. And as soon as that hit her, the call at that point, my work was essentially done, and I didn't know what the result would be, but everything had shifted. Her voice changed, her mood changed, and the plan was maybe she would make an appointment and she, something to that effect. So she got back to me soon after. The morning after that phone call, her right lung reinflated. And of course, I never ever saw her. She never came into my clinic or anything like that. But that's a prime example of healing of the body that's really rooted in some kind of malaise of the soul. And in the West, in the developed world, where we have almost everything we need outwardly, food, shelter, clothing, almost all of us have that, even people, even those who are considered poor in America, unless you're homeless. We have so much more than a poor person in some other part of the world. That here in this part of the world, the illnesses are primarily spiritual. And I have to tell you, I mean, on a daily basis, I speak with people who are miserable, deeply sad, or very upset because of the great kind of spiritual poverty that it seems to pervade, you know, so many parts of the world today, unfortunately. And they are, you know, they're on the path. They're searching for meaning, and what is central to that is knowing oneself. And, you know, as you know, in our tradition, the Prophet of Islam, he said, you know, he who knows himself knows his Lord. And so to be intimate with the source of good, to be intimate with the divine, one can't circumvent the self. That actually to know the divine, one has to walk through his or her own soul and heart to get there. And I'll share one more story, a patient story, an interpersonal story. Let me think of a good one. Yes, so I had a patient who had extraordinary lower back pain and made an appointment, and she never showed up. And then her husband called me and said she's in the hospital and they put her on morphine. Her back pain was so extraordinary. And so a month later, she called up again and she said, I'd like to come in. And so then I saw her for the first time, and I did some work on her directly, because usually when a person has acute pain, I really want to sort of give them some relief right away. So I don't talk much, and then I'll just treat them. And if the issue is really physical, then I would expect it to get better and it to hold to a certain degree, and maybe they would get a few more sessions. And if it isn't a very sophisticated physical issue, then it will resolve pretty quickly. But if it's in the soul, then the physical work will help. It lasts for a few hours, and then everything will go back to the way it used to be, which is exactly what happened with her. So in the second session, I didn't do any work on her, and we just talked the whole time. I put her on the table so she could relax, and I just conversed with her, and I asked her questions. And it turned out that her back pain had manifested after her sister had committed suicide. And her sister had severed their relationship some 15 years or so prior to the suicide. And her sister was younger. And when she was growing up, she, the older daughter, essentially raised the younger daughter because the mother wasn't quite there in that way. So she felt tremendous responsibility for this younger girl, her sister, whom she loved dearly. And she allowed herself to essentially be a doormat for a long time. And her sister was very troubled and would take it out on her. And so finally, as grown adults, her sister finally just severed the relationship. And this was deeply heartbreaking for this woman. And so she felt really guilty when her sister committed suicide, that she had done something wrong herself that had led to her sister's suicide. The moment that this woman realized that she was not responsible for her sister's suicide, and subsequently that she was not responsible for her sister being a generally troubled person, and that could be true while simultaneously loving her deeply and caring about her, then she literally, the session was done. She got up off the table. She had no pain, and she has had no pain since then. She came in a second time, and we just did a sort of a review to kind of anchor in the, you know, what she realized. And that was it. It was that simple. And that guilt was literally binding up her back energetically and causing a compression that was causing this excruciating pain. And then she was able to really have closure after that. She took her sister's ashes, and she was, you know, supposed to scatter them somewhere. And so she took a trip where she could really get closure and affirm her love for her sister, but also be at peace with everything that had happened up until that point.
Is
So this
there
goes back to the idea that, you know, that we're not merely connected, that we're actually one. That what happens in your brother or sister, whether they are literally your brother or sister, on some level is happening inside of us. And, you know, we've heard some of the recent neuroscience on this that has been quoted by some of the friends in Wednesday nights, that if you look at, if you see someone and they're experiencing emotion, that you, your brain starts to activate and you will also start to feel it. But it's even much deeper than that, because, you know, we can kind of explain that with basic science. But what's really remarkable, and this goes back to what you said earlier, Nosheen, is that you can actually feel and perceive what people are feeling and perceiving, even if they're in China and you're in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
If you tune into them. But to tune into them and feel at that level, you have to care. You have to, you know, pay attention and focus and be receptive and surrender and make space for that. Whether or not you should is another story. Because obviously, if someone has some healing themselves to do, it's probably not a good time to start trying to help other people too much. But, you know, there's a time and place for everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those were powerful examples in those stories, Ilias. And, you know, as you were sharing, I was reflecting on Nipun's thoughts earlier in the call, where, you know, a person's life could be turned upside down in a moment's notice. And sometimes that illness is not just physical. But to your point, to understand that illness is also sometimes primarily in the soul. And, you know, our journey sometimes is arriving at closure and peace. So I was thinking in terms of stories. I want to shift things a little bit to understand your story and your journey. I was speaking to Amit the other day, and we were reflecting on the fact that you've been practicing since the age of 6. I mean, how? Amit and I were joking, and, you know, he mentioned he was running off or falling off of his bicycle, and you were healing. So tell us about that.
Well, basically, it started with my father engaging me in using my body for healing. And it started with teaching me how to manipulate his spine with my feet. And I would basically walk on his back, and I would manipulate the tissue around the spinal cord and decompress his spine, which, you know, if you've ever had it done, it feels fantastic. And because I wasn't, you know, a grown adult, then it was feasible to break his back. So that lasted for a while. And then as I got bigger, then I started, and I also used my hands. But as I got bigger and stronger, then I stopped walking on him and I started using my hands instead. So he essentially, after having worked on him frequently for years and years and years, after just the first few years, find everything with my hands. So my hands knew the anatomy, and my hands knew what felt good, right? What felt healthy. And my hands also knew what was off when something was wrong. Mm-hmm. So within just a few years, I could find pretty much everything. And there was very little conversation. This wasn't a blackboard education. It was really, you know, a traditional form of education, which was through direct experience. So that was really the gift that he gave me, was of introducing me to an experience, you know, opening a doorway to experience and supporting it. And so that my own, you know, so innate senses could be activated and abilities could be awakened. And then over the years, I would just build on that. And initially, it wasn't anything that I pursued consciously. I only realized that that's what I needed to be doing when I, when someone else told me. I was in a massage class and I was the demonstration person. And my friend, who was the teacher, would have me reciprocate on him. And it was one day after reciprocating that he looked at me and he asked me where I learned what I was doing. And I told him, and he said, you know, that's not something that you can teach someone. And then that was the moment I really knew, you know, I needed to take that seriously and look into that.
Well, that's really neat that your journey started by, you know, as a 6-year-old manipulating and decompressing his spine with your feet. That's really neat. I wish I could get some 6-year-olds to do that for my back. But you know, so Elias, tell us about healing that you've required in your life. I know you've had some near-death experiences, and talk to us about the healing that you've sought or have had and your journey through that healing.
So, you know, I would say that every human being has experiences, and none of them are accidental. And just like Rahul running into this lady at the restaurant was able to take a step back and realize that, wait a second, something is happening. It's strange. And the strangeness of it is in and of itself a sign. And there's something in here for me. I should listen, and I can really, you know, receive possibly some wisdom through this. So nothing is accidental. And one of the ways in which I've really learned about healing and medicine is through the direct experience of getting sick. And it's also critical to the work I do so that I never get tired of hearing people share the stories of their suffering. Because it's your problem when, you know, a practitioner is listening to people talk about their suffering and they don't care, or they're, you know, overwhelmed, or it just sounds like complaining. And that's, in that moment, they really cannot hold a space for a person's healing if the compassion or spaciousness within themselves is shut down. So I would certainly get sick whenever that would happen inside of me as a practitioner. But also since an early age, I took life very seriously. And I knew something profound was going on. And that arose really out of going through some major life challenges, such as moving from, my family basically had to flee from Iran, and we lost everything in the transition. So we went from being very well off to essentially having nothing when we came to the United States. And then over the course of the years, I would lose each of my senses for a certain period of time. So I couldn't see for about a month. My eyes were sealed shut. I lost the ability to talk for about 6 months. I lost my hearing for a stretch. I couldn't walk at different times. And in each of those experiences, I would reflect, and I would have to make some other kind of adjustment. So I remember when I lost my voice, that was a problem because I was a clinical resident in acupuncture school. And, you know, you have to be able to talk to your patients, ask them questions. So I was forced to do diagnosis and treatment without really being able to talk. And I had assistants who would basically take up some of the slack. But what it forced me to do is learn how to deeply listen without being able to get information in secondary ways like asking questions. And I had to be able to feel what people were feeling in their bodies, in their souls, and to basically read them directly, energetically. And so this is a major point I'd really love to highlight in this session, which is that the most sensitive device in all of creation is the human heart. And there's no technology in the world today, and I don't think we'll ever have that kind of technology, that can know what the human heart can know. That you have the capacity to know exactly what people are feeling and thinking, and also what's going on in the body. And as you know, in the program that you're studying with me, that the first step to do that is to be able to do that for oneself. And so one really cannot be a healer until one has faced themselves and addressed their major life issues that are obstacles to being natural, healthy, and authentic. And once you have done that for yourself, then you can really truly hold a space for other people to go through that themselves. And so the human heart, I mean, it's absolutely remarkable. I'm always amazed at the capacity that we have for knowing. And of course, with greater knowledge comes greater responsibility. So these abilities, the subtle senses, they really start to open up as we become more compassionate, more considerate, more kind, merciful, loving, and generous. And this is why traditional medicine and the learning of traditional medicine has always been intimately tied to spirituality, that they're not separate. And this is why the great masters of traditional medicine, whether we're talking about Islamic medicine or Ayurveda or Chinese medicine or Tibetan medicine, in many cases were, monks, nuns, and were the centers of their communities, that they're deeply respected elders within the community, communities where they live. So the human heart, yes. And for those of you that are familiar with the HeartMath Institute, they've done these amazing studies where they found that the human heart basically has a magnetic field 50 times or so stronger than the brain, and an electric field as much as 5,000 times stronger than that of the brain. Yeah, so the heart has, as modern science today knows that the heart has, brain-like cells. And it has, and in the world of traditional things, spirituality and medicine, what we say is that the heart is the seat of intellection. Intellection as a function is centered in the heart. That the heart, you can actually think from your chest. So not just feel, but actually think from your chest. So if you can shift the center of focus from the head to the chest, in a completely different way to live. And it's profound. And what begins to happen is that instead of the earth revolving around the moon of your brain, that really the moon should revolve around the earth of the heart. As you know, of course, the moon does revolve around the earth. Is the moon is a satellite for the earth, and it's really the earth that is kind of the life-giving, the enlivened entity. So our life should really revolve around the heart, the head, the brain, thinking, and not the other way around. And the problem with being, the problem with studying anything without the spiritual context is that the ego can grow out of control, so that attention and energy is drawn up instead of to the center. It's kind of like those episodes of Star Trek where, those whole civilization is run by these brains in these, fish tanks.
Elias, I just have to say, for the benefit of the callers here, what that last point that you said in terms of the most sensitive device being the human heart and the seat of thinking in the chest, I remember listening to your lecture in Berkeley, and there was one thing I wrote down in my notebook that I posted on Facebook, and it got like 20 likes within 20 minutes. And I just want to share it for the callers here, which I think speaks to this. And this is your words, so I'm quoting you now. You said, "It is in the realization of who you are that everything that you are not can instantly dissolve." And I thought that was really powerful for me when I first heard you speak. But I know that we've got folks on.
I guess while we wait for folks to do that, I was going to throw in a question myself. Elias, you've studied so many different types of healing, from this traditional medicine of Islamic healing to acupuncture, this Chinese herbal medicine, Qigong, Japanese Tibetan Reiki. Of all of these different traditions that you've studied, what have you learned? What have you found that to be the sort of the commonality between all of them, whether it's from the perspective of the method itself or from the healers themselves?
Well, I would say that the techniques are not the heart of it. So when one realizes the treatment principle, which is to ultimately, know what is going on inside of this person that is causing their distress. And usually that distress is the meeting of multiple factors. It's what's going on in their soul, the diet, the environment, the climate, their gender, their race, their age, their vitality, ancestral influences, the quality of their relationships, the presence of poisons, unresolved trauma, and so on. So these are all the influences that come to bear in the present moment to paint the picture of what that person is dealing with in that moment. So each of the techniques is just a form of hamburger helper, that they are levers into the body, mind, soul. And what I do when I treat people is I use a cocktail of techniques as appropriate to the given circumstances. So in any given session, I might use acupuncture and do some body work and use some essential oils and prescribe an herbal formula, for example. But they are all operating on the same treatment principle. So if the treatment principle is to heal heartbreak that happens to be manifesting as stagnation in the heart physically, that might be causing, oxidative stress and, leading to hardening of the arteries and plaque formation and this kind of thing, as spoken about in modern medical terms. That could all be the result of an unresolved heartbreak from the past. So the medicine is intelligent, especially when we're talking about food and herbs. They are intelligent. They're really the best healers in the world. Whereas I really don't heal anything. I don't have anything to heal anything with. Because in the view of traditional medicine, Islamic medicine, everything ultimately comes from God. So I'm basically just a facilitator. But natural things such as herbs are living beings, and they are the best healers, and you just have to find the right match. So they go and they do extraordinary things. So the same herbs that clear stagnant blood from the heart, that rejuvenate the heart, are also the herbs that spiritually deal with heartbreak issues. So the acupuncture points that deal with things of the heart that have the same function, are spiritually also dealing with heartbreak. So each of the techniques of healing, whether they are manual, herbal, essential oils, acupuncture, energy work, in a sense, it almost doesn't matter which one you use, as long as you're skilled enough to apply it to touch the deeper place in the human being. And that's really the key. So when I studied, I wanted to understand all the layers of a human being and have a way to directly access any one of those layers. So I learned manual therapies. I learned subtle energy-based therapies. I learned about food and herbal medicine. And so I wanted a comprehensive way to support people, and to have a decent sense of how each of those worlds functions. But what I discovered is that they all get to the same reality, just through a different avenue.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And beating, bowing down from my heart space, Elias, thank you so much for this, incredible holistic healing insights. Either if you have a story to share from the life of the honeybees, perhaps the one that you had shared a while back, that I was deeply touched about the honeybee in the Wednesday circle, or anything that pops up, I would like to like to ask to open your heart that you hold for these honeybees, anything that emerges. Thank you.
Oh, there's so much to say about bees. There's so much to say. So, you know, it's interesting. In 2001, I did a retreat, and in the retreat space where I was staying, there were just a few books. There was a book about the names of God, and there was a Quran, which is the sacred scripture of Islam. And I wasn't reading too much. I was mostly praying and meditating, and over the course of some days. And there was a beautiful kind of like what looked like a mosaic on the cover of this book called The 99 Names of God. And at some point I flipped to the, you know, inside or back cover to read about the mosaic. And it turned out that there was a Turkish man, a beekeeper in Turkey, who one morning when he opened up one of the, you know, the beehives, he saw that all of the honeycombs that were filled spelled the name of God in Arabic. And the picture I had been looking at on the front of the book was of that, a picture that he took of that honeycomb. And then I opened up the Quran at random at one point, and it opened up to the chapter of the bee that describes exactly what you're talking about, which is the selflessness of the bees and the wonder, you know, of God's creation manifesting as the bees and how the bees live. And it was quite an event to, you know, to during this retreat. And of course, there was much that I gleaned in that experience. And I'll briefly share the story of the one teacher I had, who is a sheikh, an imam of the Dome of the Rock, which is in Jerusalem, which is the rock where it's believed that Abraham had almost sacrificed his son. And so when this teacher of mine who grew up on the Mount of Olives, when he was 12 years old, he was in a granary on the Mount of Olives, and he noticed that there was a bee picking up grain and transporting it somewhere. And he thought this was strange because he didn't understand what a bee had anything to do with grain. So he managed to catch it in a matchbox and tie a thread around one of its legs so he could let it fly away and follow it. And he noticed that the bee, he followed it for something like 200 yards, and finally he saw where it was landing. And he saw that there was a chick that had been abandoned, and it was blind. And this bee was basically transporting grain to the chick and dropping the grain into the bird's mouth. And he went and told his father, who was the imam at the time of the mosque, and it was Friday, which is the holy day for Muslims where you have a communal prayer service. And it begins with the imam basically giving, you know, a sermon. And so the imam was so moved by this event that he gave a sermon on the mercy of God. The mercy of God, even in its manifestation and severity, is still mercy, and it pervades existence. That there is not a single thing in creation that is left behind, that is forgotten. And if it ever looks that way, it's only because we're not seeing the whole picture. So don't believe what you see on TV too much, because it's very seldom the real picture. But most of the good news and the wonderful things that are happening on the planet that are really pervasive, they just don't get the airtime because they're not very sensational. But the reality is that the mercy of God is pervasive. And going back to what Rahul said earlier about assuming value everywhere, it's so true that if you actually just stop everything, pause, and look around, value is innate. And the question really is, do we notice it? And if we do, to what extent are we willing to participate in it? And in some cases, that takes, you know, going right back to what Audrey said, it takes a lot of courage to, you know, invite it forward in places where it may be overcast.
Thank you, Rubia. Just want to say we have just a few more minutes left, and we do have a couple of questions in the queue here, so hopefully we can get through them. And then again, for if we do run over by a few minutes, if people have to, well, first, Elias, do you have a few more extra minutes to get through some of these additional
questions? Absolutely, I can stay as long as people are interested. I'm happy to stay.
And for those of you that, you know, cannot stay past the 1:30, just wanted to thank you in advance again for helping hold it and co-create this space. So the next question, please.
Elias, this is Nipun. I feel like anything anyone will say will have something profoundly inspiring to say. So, but my question is sort of brief, but around this topic of Islamic healing, how pervasive is it? How many people are practicing it? How many people even know that it exists? Because I remember when I first heard it, I thought to myself, wow, I didn't know such a field existed. So, can you just give, in brief, some context around how pervasive the field is?
Sure. So I'll take a step back and give a little bit of background really quickly. Spiritual people are the most dangerous people in the world to the status quo of greed and power. And so, unfortunately, you know, because you can't buy them, they're not interested in, you know, the swampland that is being offered to them. So of course, this invariably brings them under a lot of pressure and a lot of fire. So it's not an accident that the great healers, the great practitioners of traditional medicine around the world have come under attack. And usually the people of any society that preserve the spiritual traditions are targets when there's a vying for power. So all of the systems of medicine, the four systems, have all come under attack at different points in history. So the communists in China almost destroyed Chinese medicine, but they had to bring it back because it worked, and they have millions of people in the population who desperately needed it. And Mao Zedong got so sick, and the doctors, the MDs, couldn't do anything for him. So they brought back a great practitioner of Chinese medicine who healed him. So that's why Chinese medicine has survived. But they flattened it. They communized it. They sucked the spirituality out of it. And so the same thing happened when the Chinese invaded Tibet. One of the first things they tried to do was destroy Tibetan medicine. And when the British invaded the subcontinent, they basically, you know, attacked Ayurveda and Islamic medicine. So fortunately, three of those four systems today are thriving. They're doing really well. But Islamic medicine is the one that's really in dire straits. Because of its proximity to Europe and the seat of colonialism, it took the biggest hit, and the Arab world has long since bought modernity and fallen in love with all things modern, including modern science and modern medicine. And so traditional medicine of the Muslim world is either seen as backward, barbaric, or as something associated with witchcraft, which in the Abrahamic world is a death sentence. And so you can find it in pockets around the world, in Morocco, in Africa, in Egypt and Turkey and Syria and Iran. And I mean, it's well established. A branch of it that primarily deals with herbal and food medicine is very well established in India and Pakistan, to the point where there are something like 70 institutes in India alone. But the real masters and the real tradition is dying because there are very few masters around to preserve it. There are literally just a few practitioners in this country. There's one in the UK, and only God knows how many there are elsewhere. But part of my work, when I especially, God willing, if I ever get the funding to do the documentary, part of my plan when I travel is to meet with them, to establish a connection with them, and to work together in reviving the medicine.
Thank you. Next caller.
Hello, Brother Ilyas. Thank you so much for sharing all of your insight and your wisdom. And this is Parth calling from New Jersey. And I had a personal question for you. During those moments where maybe you lose connection or maybe get mired in the day-to-day of what life offers and what life has to bring, what are some practices that you use to ground yourself, to bring yourself back into connection?
Well, being a Muslim, one of the outer life is really draped over the inner life. And so throughout the day, I do the standard Islamic practices that are really connected to the cosmos. So, we pray 5 times a day, and those times punctuated by the movement of the sun and the moon. So if I start to forget, nature is constantly calling me back, which is a really awesome thing. You know how some people put a meditation bell on their computer or on their cell phone? Well, the sun, and the planets and the moon, that's my meditation bell. So I don't have to turn on, some device that can be left in the car, left in my apartment if I forget it, that I'm constantly being reminded by the cosmos. And I really feel incomplete if I don't make my prayers. So, we pray 5 times a day, and usually after each prayer, I do an invocation, what you would call mantra in the Hindu tradition. And then I'll sit in meditation. And I have life strategies I use, turn off technology. I don't really watch much TV. If I listen to radio, I try to do it consciously, and I'm very particular about what I listen to. And I have these practices I do throughout the day. And I would suggest, that if a person really wants awakening, you have to persist in remembering the sacred perpetually until you don't forget it. So one goes from having to remind oneself to be centered and grounded and in the heart to instead just catching yourself when you fall out. So if you're having to remind yourself to come back to your center constantly back, trying to come back, that's very different than just noticing when you fall out. So I say to people who are really serious, persist in your return to your center. And I use, of course, theistic language when I talk to some people. So I would say, in your remembrance of God, persist until you get to the place where you just don't forget anymore. And it's sort of like the image I like is of like the space shuttle, taking off. It takes a tremendous amount of, everything has to be in place, right? It has to be, ready to take off, everything lined up, and that takes tremendous energy. And as soon as it takes off, it catches fire because the friction with the atmosphere, the surface of the space shuttle starts to burn. So this is like spiritual practice, that as soon as you start doing it and you start encountering the samskaras, right, all the obscurations of the soul that are stored in the body, all the unresolved hurts and trauma and all the negativity, that when you turn your attention inward and you face the divine and you start to call and try to make that connection, that everything that is not you is being challenged in that moment, including unconsciousness. And it starts to shake and it starts to burn. So people will cry, people will perspire, people will get anxious and uncomfortable. And then, but the moment of truth is when you literally, you know, you break the sound barrier, which is you penetrate through the mind, through the mental plane of existence, which is torture because it's constantly chattering and it never, you know, it was designed to chatter, but and it has a place in our lives, but it shouldn't be. If you live there, it's rough, to say the least. So you break through that layer, and you can't just do it by sheer force of will. It really takes surrender because you're really descending through the layer to the deep interior of who you are. But using this image, right, you break through the atmosphere, and then you're in outer space where there's complete peace, complete silence, and you're just floating. And the pressure of existence is off, right? You're in a no-gravity space. So the pressure of dense existence is not really oppressing you. And this is really the space of meditation. And so a very powerful conduit to that tranquil center is the practice of, you know, essentialized prayer or invocation, you know, where you repeat some sacred word or name or phrase. So usually my deepest meditation is after I've done either yoga or qigong, and my body has been slapped around and relaxed a bit. And it's essentially out of the way. The gross tension of the body is out of the way. And then I'm able to easily go through the mind into the heart. So those are some things I would recommend.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Wanted to thank everyone for joining the call today. Ilias, thank you so much for the incredible shares that you gave to us today. I wouldn't even know where to start. I guess if I were to just sum it up, there was a quote that Daily Good actually recently tweeted, and it seems to get to the heart of some of what you were saying in terms of, you know, if you want the truth, I'll tell you the truth. Listen to the secret sound, the real sound, which is inside you. And so I truly appreciate it. And that was a quote from Kabir, actually. And really appreciate you taking the time to share some of your journey, and Nosheen as well for just doing such a wonderful job with moderating. We were hoping that we could close out the call as we normally do with another minute of silence and gratitude. And so gratitude for this call, for these calls weekly, for everyone helping co-create this space, and for individuals like yourself that take the time to share their journeys. So,
can I say just one more thing before we get there?
Absolutely.
Great. So, well, I want to thank everyone. Thank you, Amit, for facilitating this. Thank you, Nosheen, for facilitating. And I really want to thank all the listeners and the great questions and all the tremendous heart and presence and listening that has been brought to this session. And I really want to thank Nippon and the service space community as a whole, who has really inspired me, I must say, since I've discovered them. And it's really helped me to actually take my world work to the next level. And I will say that one of the ahas that I've had since finding the community is, and I've really seen Nippon really do it quite remarkably, which is this whole rock soup magic thing that he does. You know, where you show up in the village and all you have is like a bowl, and you invite people to come and to share, and everyone is inspired by the spirit, and they all start giving what they really have, and they feel, you know, and they're able to relax into that. So in terms of my own work and my project, instead of the, you know, if you build it, they will come, I'm actually inspired these days, you know. So this phrase in my head is, if you come, they will build it. And if anyone is interested in knowing more about that, you can check it out on my website. But the latest thing I'm trying to do is this, is to actually build a center to continue the work I do on a bigger scale, so I can actually really, really serve people more comprehensively than I have been able to. But I just wanted to give my thanks and gratitude for all the inspiration and wisdom that has come Nippon and his family and service space in moving me, you know, in my own continued growth in that direction. So thank you.
Thank you. And we will make sure that we'll send a follow-up email to everyone with more information on that current project and some of the other projects that you've been working on, because they're incredibly interesting. So thank you again. And a minute of gratitude, please. Again, thank you everyone for joining the call. One of the last thing that we like to do before we completely sign off is, you know, we take everyone kind of off mute, and we say sort of a large group thank you to our guest speaker today, Ilias. And so I'm going to just remove everyone off mute, and then on the count of three, if we can all just say a big warm thank you and send our gratitude to Ilias, really appreciate it. So one, two, and three.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a high five from the heart.